We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is Jim Kunzler, the creator of the Kunzler Cast podcast, author of many books, and also the blog Clusterfuck Nation, and a painter. How are you today, Jim?
I'm just dandy here in upstate New York.
It's great to have you. And I had a listener reach out after the Tom Luongo podcast and suggest me sitting down and having a chat with you, because you recently interviewed Tom as well. And there's kind of a lot of the same parallels in the conversations that we're having. So, you know, after going through your blog and some of your books, I came across your book, Living in the Long Emergency. And in that book, you start to explore the idea of living in a very complex society. So I've spoken with a couple other guests before about this idea, but I think the point worth exploring a little bit more is the idea of these complex societies. So how do these complexities, you know, as they grow and become more complex, of course, how do they end up becoming more fragile as well?
Well, let's just start by recognizing that all civilized societies are complex. You know, what I'm describing in the book you mentioned, Living in the Long Emergency, which is a sequel to my earlier book, The Long Emergency. What I'm describing really is a techno-industrial civilization that has reached a certain point in its development. And, you know, let's just be clear that everything in the universe, and especially in the human realm, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And we seem to be closer to the end of the techno-industrial orgy than we are to the middle of it. Well, and there are elements that seem to be winding down. I think that we're heading into a timeout for high-tech industrial civilization, and that in fact we're going to end up in a much more primitive way of life, not necessarily the Stone Age and not necessarily medieval, but something quite different from the fiesta of comfort and convenience that we've enjoyed in the last 100 years or so. And and I've lost my train of thought. Well, your question was something, fragility. So, one of the essential problems with what we're doing is, as the anthropologist Joseph Tainter has said in his version of this story, his book, The Collapse of Complex Societies, that you get to a point where highly complex societies start to make overinvestments in hyper complexity with diminishing returns. And that's a mouthful, but what it really means is, you know, the more add-ons and the more layers of complexity you add to your society, the more fragile that whole uber system of systems becomes. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what we're seeing with, especially in the last decade or so, where the tendency in our culture is, whenever we're presented with a problem, to add yet another layer of complexity to a problem that's already highly overly technical. And, where is that taking us? It's taking us to a point where the diminishing returns will express themselves as the collapse of various systems that we depend on, like oil production, gas production, or just gas distribution, as we're seeing now with the problems following the Russian cleanup operation in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And these failures of systems tend to amplify and ramify the failures of other systems that they're connected to. So for example, you know, if the oil delivery system in Europe stumbles, so is all of the industrial production of Europe, including all the car industry in Germany. I'm sorry. And, you know, every other important industry in Europe. So, you know, you'll see it also ramifying in, you know, if we run into problems with petroleum and you know, gasoline, diesel, which we are clearly heading into, that is going to ramify and it's going to upset the trucking system, which will ramify the problems with food delivery, which will end up, you know, with X amount of shelves in the supermarkets being bare and people having a hard time getting food. And of course, that ends up ramifying the political subsystem. And we, you know, it tends to push us into social disorder. So you can see how all these systems and subsystems are interconnected, and their successes or failures or stumbles will affect all the other systems. And that's where we're at. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the book, you kind of go through the 2008 great financial collapse as an example of this fragility manifesting. And, you know, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, the scale of that bailout versus maybe the scale of the COVID bailout and the consequences of that much debt being piled on.
Yeah, well, I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but you know, let's say the people of America kind of gasped in 2009 when you know, the great financial collapse was in full flower, and Obama had just been elected, and he had taken on board as advisors many of the senior bankster people who had kind of caused the problem. You know, people like Robert Rubin and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury, and you know, the bailouts had proceeded already under his predecessor, Mr. Bush, in the fall of 2008 after the election. But I don't think that, and that was under Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, I don't think that the bailouts amounted to more than $1 trillion at the time. It's debatable because, you know, there was a lot of bailing out of non-American banks as well, European banks and probably, you know, perhaps even Canadian, Australian banks. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of action that was kind of off the books. But it still doesn't really compare to the trillions that we've racked up promiscuously during the COVID episode. And just, you know, the fantastically promiscuous and capricious way that billions and billions were doled out. You know, it kind of reminds us of that old crack that the senator from Illinois, what was his name? Everett Dirksen, was the minority leader in the 50s and early 60s. And he made this famous crack back then, a billion here, a billion there. Sooner or later, you're talking about real money. And that was back when $1 billion was real money. Everett Dirksen had a particularly stentorian and comical way of speaking, but he's unfortunately, alas, forgotten, along with a lot of bygone politicians. Anyway, yeah, I think that the amount of money that we poured into, that we created and put on the debt ledgers has been far exceeded anything that happened in 2008 and 9, and has gotten to the point that's so absurd that it's almost impossible to imagine these banking systems carrying on. Because, you know, basically we're faced with a problem that it is self-evident to everybody that these loans will never be serviced or paid back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't have a fiat monetary system based on lending if the lending is cannot be credibly and plausibly serviced, that is the interest paid, and paid off, that is the you know, the principal erased. Mm-hmm. So it's a terrible conundrum and a terrible quandary we're in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely insane to think about the amount of quote unquote money that has been, let's say, added to the national debt, right? I had one guest kind of conceptualize it that $1 trillion is equivalent to spending $1 per second for 31,710 years, right?
Yeah, you're really reaching into incomprehensible amounts of numbers. You know, it's just, there are all kinds of, physical analogies, like the rows, if you extended the dollars end to end, you know, they'd end, that amount of money would land in Alpha Centauri. You know, it would take light years for it to get to where, it's just insane. So the interesting thing at the moment is how all of a sudden new factors have come in to prang the system. It didn't get to the point where the failure to pay back the debt and service the debt actually undermined the system. Instead, what happened was that we attempted to impose sanctions on Russia, and the consequences of doing that were that Russia suddenly rolled into a gold-backed currency, or what appears to be forming as a gold-backed currency. And they really turned the tables on the U.S. and Western civ, assuming that people think that Europe and the USA are apart from Russia in Western civ. I'm not so sure about that. In fact, I've got a kind of a strange and probably unpopular sense of things that it may be Mr. Putin who's defending Western civilization better than our leaders. Mm-hmm. And Western values to some extent, especially the value of presenting reality truthfully. But anyway, Russia has accomplished this turnaround, and that seems to be the thing that is undermining the dollar much more than the mere fact that we've created this background of debt that that also ought to undermine the soundness of the dollar, but seems to have not been able to do that through all these many years of money printing. So it's the Russian situation that's really interesting, and their workaround of the various trade transaction settlement systems that we have kicked them out of, the SWIFT system, and the fact that they were prepared with a system of their own in cooperation with China to work around such a thing happening as America kicking them out of the SWIFT system. And what we've succeeded in doing is just really undermining the dollar. Mm-hmm. So that could end up playing out very quickly. And seems to be, and it's not just the dollar, actually. The news was announced yesterday, I think, by the German government that they expected food prices to rise by 20 to 50% in just the next week. And that's mm-hmm. that's a startling thing. And, you know, what it means is that people's standard of living in Europe is automatically going down by double digits, Food isn't all of their monthly expenditures, but it's higher in Europe than it is in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's really going to hurt them.
That was, kind of one of the next things I did want to ask you about is, like in a recent blog, you wrote that our response to Russia will be to wreck the global economy, starting with the international monetary system. So, is this just another example of very poor foresight by the U.S. administration?
Well, it sure seems to be. You know, it seems to be a level of stupidity that's almost incomprehensible, you know, especially not reckoning any consequences from this, you know, move to sanction Russia and kick it out of the SWIFT system, meaning they wouldn't be able to conduct any international trade. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is that they have an economy that's based on commodity resources, you know, metals, petroleum, natural gas, things that people really need. You know, whereas, you know, all we're selling is Disney movies and you know, we're extra trying to export inflation mm-hmm. through our trade deficit. So the Russians are clearly in a better position to be able to trade stuff for stuff than we are. And, you know, we have eliminated the thing that kept us going, which is our ability to just export dollars and inflation and get stuff from other countries in return. Mm-hmm. And now that's going to stop, especially, you know, as our dollar loses value, or that we've simply foreclosed trade with Russia, which means that there are an awful lot of metals that we need for the regular production of stuff. Manufacturing still exists in the United States, which probably isn't a lot, but, you know, we're not going to be able to get finished products from other lands, and God knows how we're going to get automobile parts. I would imagine there are a lot of people, you know, in the automobile business and in the automobile repair business who are really sweating it out now. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of common things that I know about in the construction industry, you know, like plate glass and lumber or fabricated materials that you have to wait months for specialty materials. You know, a friend of mine lost a window in a steel security door, and she was told it would take 4 months to get a glass replacement for that particular door. Mm-hmm. For her bookstore. So, you know, what we've done is we've blown up global trade arrangements that were very, very deep and complex, and that allowed us to, you know, have all of these comforts and conveniences because we were able to repair them. But now, you know, everything from electronics and solar electric systems to parts of cars to, you know, machine parts that we need for any kind of machine you can imagine, to computer chips. You know, all of these things are going to be harder to get, mm-hmm. maybe impossible to get in some cases. And that could lead to some very serious breakdowns in things running well in the United States, and certainly in Europe, and I suppose in Canada too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's insane to think about the amount of metals that we need to actually be able to, you know, quote unquote, make the transition to a greener way of living. You know,
that ain't going to happen. I mean, that let's just be clear from the outset. We're not going to enter the kind of alt energy nirvana that so many people are yakking about. I wrote a book published a book in 2012 or 11 called Too Much Magic. Mm-hmm. And it was about wishful thinking and technology. And, you know, we're really stuck in this wishful thinking cul-de-sac, you know, blind alley that is not taking us anywhere. We are not going to run suburbia, the interstate highway system, Kmart, Walmart, the U.S. military, Walt Disney World, on any combination of alt energy, wind, solar, used French fried potato oil, you know, whatever you got, mm-hmm. you know, that ain't going to happen. And largely because you need a platform of a fossil fuel economy to fabricate and run those systems. You know, they're not going to run off themselves. And our platform of fossil fuels is kind of wobbling right now pretty badly. And it's not going to get a whole lot better. So, you know, that expectation, it just isn't going to happen. There are things we can do, but they're not things that we're talking about. And mainly they revolve around two things: relocalizing our lives, which means, you know, everything from food production to making stuff, and selling and moving and transporting and retailing and wholesaling stuff, and governing, and downscaling all of these activities so that they can be relocalized. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's producing electric power or making things that are sold regionally, you know, using the resources that we have. For example, I live in a part of the United States, in northeastern United States, that happens to have a lot of water power potential. In fact, there are many hydro sites along the river that runs through my town, which is a tributary of the Hudson River. Mm-hmm. There are many hydro sites that the ruins of the power stations are still there, but the sites were abandoned. So that in the early 20th century, we used a lot of those hydro sites, you know, where the level of the river drops 6 feet or something, you know, and they can harness that drop. You know, we used that in the early 20th century. And then when the big electric companies consolidated into, you know, Niagara Mohawk and now National Grid, which is owned by the UK. You know, the UK owns our electric system here in the Northeast. All those old small hydro sites were abandoned as, you know, uneconomical. You had to hire somebody to be there, and he had to take the trash out of the intake of the turbine intake and all that. So that's the kind of thing we're going to need. And the places that don't have those resources are going to be in trouble. The places that don't have good agricultural land proximate to them. You know, I expect places like the desert southwest of the USA, you know, Arizona, parts of Southern California and New Mexico, to really be depopulated, because they're not going to be able to grow a whole lot of food over there. Mm-hmm. You know, not to mention their water problems. So downscaling and relocalizing is probably the key to where we're going. And, you know, it also implies quite a bit of simplification of our lives. I, for one, am not all that sanguine about the prospect of the internet continuing forever, or even another 20 years necessarily. It's entirely dependent on a reliable electric grid. And the electric grid, which has been described as the biggest machine in the world, is one of the most fragile subsystems in our overall system of comfort and convenience. So, you know, it has been terribly fragile, and there is a great deal of worry among people who understand how it works about it being interrupted or taken down, you know, or frazzled with an EMP, an electromagnetic pulse, which all nuclear armed countries are capable of pulling off. So simplicity, downscaling, relocalizing, these are the keys to what we need to do. Those are the signals that reality is sending to us and telling us to be attentive to.
Mm-hmm. Well, to your point, Jim, I think, you know, we saw partially how fragile the grid is in that winter storm in Texas last year, right?
Yeah, and Texas has a separate grid. It's like mm-hmm. a Texas only grid that is separate from other parts of the U.S. electric grid. And their whole thing went down for, what, a couple of weeks or something for some people? Mm-hmm. And it was rather hard and expensive to restore it. And it got, you know, overloaded in an ice storm, couldn't handle the load, and, you know, the transformers blew, and Bob's your uncle. Mm-hmm.
So are you not, let's say, optimistic that there are going to be any types of technological advancements to solve some of these problems, Jim?
No, I don't believe it. You know, nuclear fusion, for example, has been, they joke about it saying, it's the energy of the future and always will be. You know, a lot of these schemes are perpetual motion ideas when you, you know, when you clear away a lot of the BS. Mm-hmm. I certainly think that there will be some kind of, there will be technological something, but it may be a lot simpler. I mean, for example, we have no idea how we're going to conduct agriculture outside of the model that we've been using, which includes the import of tremendous amounts of fertilizers or natural, you know, or turning natural gas into fertilizer, or especially using debt for these gigantic farms to get their crops in every year. You know, they have to borrow like $250,000 to purchase the inputs to get the crop in. And then if the crop, you know, fails, you know, they've got a huge debt problem. Mm-hmm. And crops do fail. And, you know, we do have some janky weather. I'm not sold on the global warming story per se. In fact, I think there's a possibility that we're entering a cooling cycle, you know, for reasons having to do with sunspots. And, you know, there are various cycles that exist in the universe that are cycles within cycles, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, 80-year cycles and 10-year cycles. And that's why it's very hard to model all that. You know, the indications right now are that we may be heading into a cooling, right? Not a warming. So, you know, that may affect the grain-growing regions of the U.S. and Canada and Russia and Ukraine, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, how are we going to do agriculture in the future if it's not modeled on, you know, million-dollar harvesting machines run by diesel? And part of the answer is, you know, and this is, I'm sure, unacceptably weird for many people, you know, we may have to use animals again. We may have to use oxen, mules, and horses, and we may need to have machines that can be used with them. You know, they'll be more primitive than a John Deere 2022 model of a giant tractor, you know, that has hookups for video screens and, you know, GPS, and the person running the tractor can just sit in there and watch movies while they're going back and forth on a 4,000 acre farm in Iowa. And the, in fact, in many cases, well, in fact, I'm sure that farm machinery is being designed to be, in effect, a drone that doesn't require a human pilot even to sit in it. So how long is that going to last? I don't think it's going to last very long. I think we're going to have to be thrown back on other methods of feeding ourselves. And some of them are going to seem to be pretty primitive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, like to your point there, it's crazy to think about the amount of complexity that has entered into the farming system, and then seeing the effects of the inability to get chips and parts, and even the ability to repair any of those tractors. I know John Deere had some issues where they're basically fighting the right to repair. They're fighting the farmer's ability to repair their own machines, and that's just,
yeah, that's the same as the car industry. You know, there are very few backyard mechanics now because, you know, everything's computerized, and it's, you know, hard unless you have one of those diagnostic systems, you know, that they have in the car dealerships. It's hard to repair your car.
Absolutely.
So I don't know, you know,
go ahead.
There may be, you know, in the twilight of the mass motoring age, there may be a lot of people buying antique, 1964 Chevy pickups. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a distinct possibility in real times of crisis when we can't get the electronics.
Yeah.
Jim, I'd like to kind of go back to a part of your book. In part three, you focus on the question of now what? So what were some
of the... That was going to be the title of the book, by the way. but the publishers wouldn't let me call it that. I was so pissed off about it. I thought, now what? question mark would be a great book title, you know, short and sweet.
Especially as a follow-on to the original.
Yeah, and I didn't want to even use, but they said, well, the Long Emergency is your brand. You got to use that in the title. You know, they're such idiots. The book publishing world is just so, it's, you know, it's been a thorn in my side my whole 40-year career.
So what were some of the conclusions that you came to about what is happening to us and what plans that we can make to do about it?
Well, the overall conclusion I came to is that we are unable to construct a coherent consensus about what's happening, and therefore we can't construct any kind of a coherent plan to do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Now, as I said, you know, my idea of a coherent plan would be plan to downsize, plan to downscale, and plan to go local. And if we had a set of policies that were based on that, we might actually land, you know, have a softer landing than otherwise. But that's not a popular point of view. And, you know, there is such a thing as momentum in the world. And, you know, you set such a large system in motion with all of its many pieces, you know, much more complicated than a Swiss watch and much bigger than a Swiss watch. Mm-hmm. And the system is out there whirring away. And it can even have a couple of parts, you know, go idle or fall off or break, and the system's still lurching on. And the momentum of just the weight of the flywheel itself is tremendous. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that the financial system didn't just, you know, fall on its face in 2008, 2009.
What are some of the plans we can make to kind of counteract this? You know, you mentioned kind of in some ways, you know, coming back to an idea of community and less complexity. But I wanted to ask you how gold fits into your view.
Well, let me answer your first question. Okay. For example, one of the things that we probably have to pay attention to is that big box shopping, you know, as we've organized retail over the last 30 years or so, you know, it's not a permanent installation in the human condition. We're going to have to move away from that. You know, we're going to need to completely reorganize how we do commerce, and probably back into the Main Street model of local regional commerce in walkable communities. You know, all these components will come together. We're not going to have mass motoring after a certain point. And we can talk about why that's so and why it's fairly close, but we're not. And so, you know, driving to the Walmart is not going to be an option. We're going to have to reactivate all those main streets out there and all those downtowns. We're going to have local wholesalers and local jobbers and the whole infrastructure of local commerce that used to be there that's not there anymore. And one of the components of that is, you know, when you have local family-owned or small businesses that sell stuff, they are truly local, they will employ their neighbors. They will employ the people who live in their town. And one thing that means is that people in business in a small town or in a small city will occupy two roles in their community. They will have a social role and an economic role. And it's very important to have those two roles. You can't just be a consumer, you know, or just have an economic role and no social role. It's unhealthy for a society or civilization. It ends up corroding it and making sure that it can't, and makes sure that it can't continue. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we understand we're going to have to restructure commerce, and it's going to have to be restructured on a smaller scale, and it will require a lot of interrelations between people who live in the same place.
So, you know, the second part of my question there, Jim, was how does gold, you know, fit into how you see that ability to transact, or let's say protect yourself from what we are seeing happening in the world right now?
Well, it's pretty simple. you know, gold has been recognized as money for thousands and thousands of years, and it will continue to be. And silver will too, although it also has other roles in our lives. Mm-hmm. You know, it depends on how industrial and technical we remain, especially for electronics. Mm-hmm. But gold and silver are important. And when fiat currencies fail, their importance reasserts itself. And as we're in the process now, having pranged the banking system over this Ukraine business, gold and silver are once again becoming important in backing currencies. And it's really revolutionary what's going on in the world right now in 2022, where, you know, some countries are actually returning to a gold-backed currency. The process isn't complete in Russia, but it's interesting how it's working right now. You know, the sanctions which prevent Russia from transacting with European countries, right? They can't use euros to buy Russian natural gas, which is mainly how they heat their homes and run their kitchens and, you know, et cetera. And so the sanctions don't allow that to happen. So the Russians have said, fine, you can either buy the oil with gold or you can buy rubles and buy it in rubles. Well, how do you buy rubles? Well, you can buy it with gold. So they've set up kind of a neat little circular situation that, you know, the Europeans are going to not have a whole lot of options for. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if people actually start using the ruble for trade throughout the world because it's stable and it's backed by gold, then, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to be standing there with our dick in our hands, basically, if you can say that on this radio. Right? Maybe not.
Well, it makes sense. And, you know, it's something that I think the world is trying to grasp is what are the consequences of Russia, you know, at least on the buy side, backing the ruble with gold.
Well, for the moment, you know, we don't know how transient the current situation is. I mean, there's an awful lot of pressure right now for the United States to soften up Russia at the bargaining table with Ukraine by agreeing to rescind the sanctions that they imposed 2-3 weeks ago, right? And I mean, that would be humiliating for the West and for the USA, but it may be necessary. I mean, they may realize, you know, how much the sanctions have boomeranged and blown up in our face. Mm-hmm. You know, it may be that they are, I mean, look, the USA has really become kind of a weak player on the game board. We've got a weak president with a very ambiguous clack of mysterious shadowy figures behind him. You know, we don't really know who's running Joe Biden, in quotation marks, as I like to say. My guess is that Barack Obama and his people are running Joe Biden, but who really knows? I don't know what the place of the so-called Davos crowd and Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum really is. I tend to discount them a bit because they have a kind of cartoon James Bond kind of look to them. You know, with Klaus Schwab, he looks like a character out of Goldfinger. You know, he should be sitting in an underground bunker with a Persian cat on his lap. And in fact, he's got this lieutenant, this Israeli nut job who, you know, makes speeches sounding like he wants to exterminate 90% of the human race, which is pretty strange coming from an Israeli. And I forget his name. But, you know, he was on YouTube this morning. Somebody sent me a thing with him. Mm-hmm. It's hard to take them seriously. I mean, they just seem like a joke. And yet, it's also very hard to explain the coordinated craziness between the various nations of Western civilization, especially the COVID response. You know, the one of the most mystifying things, if you believe, as I do, that the vaccines are less than effective, and if you believe, as I do, that the vaccines are causing an awful lot of injury and up to death because of their side effects, it's hard for me to understand why all of the Western civ nations are still urging their citizens to vax up. It's like they're trying to commit, you know, mass murder. Mm-hmm. I just don't get it. The only explanation that makes sense is the one that's been dragged into the arena by the Belgian college professor, Matthias Desmet, if that's how you pronounce his name, maybe Demet, I don't know. He's at the University of Ghent, and he has brought this theory into the arena of mass formation psychosis. And basically, it's really just the study of the madness of crowds. And we've known about the madness of crowds for millennia. And there have been instances of cultures going nuts over the years. But it's happening now in the modern era of supposedly of rationality, science, stability, reason. And yet what I observe is so many of the people I know who consider themselves to be progressive have completely lost their shit intellectually. And they now seem to believe in things that would have been unbelievable 10 years ago. Like, my progressive friends now are all completely on board with censorship, with shutting down free speech, with canceling people and depriving them of a livelihood and destroying their careers and reputations. And these are the people who are supposedly progressive in our country. I'm sorry. There's nothing progressive about that. It's just tyrannical and authoritarian and insane. And, how do you attribute that? What do you attribute that? Now, I think mass formation is probably the best explanation. These people are, in effect, you know, have had part of their brain disabled. You know, some toggle has been thrown off in their brain pan, and they're not fully functioning. If they were, they'd recognize that, you know, maybe being in favor of censorship and suppressing the news isn't a good idea. But they don't. So, you know, I'm engaged in what amounts to a war against them. And, I'm at war with the Democratic Party in America. I'm at war with the woke agenda. That's my position in this. And at the same time, I'm trying to monitor exactly how this culture is whirling around the drain.
I'd like to go back to a point that you made about the kind of the weakness that the US has shown, and kind of get your ideas about where China fits into all of this. Do you think that, you know, as part of them seeing the US's reaction to Russia, do you think that the Chinese government will, you know, up their plans or move their plans forward to reclaim Taiwan as part of their territory?
I do think that China will seek to annex Taiwan back into their country. I think China is in a strange position. They have managed very adroitly to position themselves in what seems to be the sidelines of the Russia-Ukraine-US proxy war. They have made gestures to help the Russians and to establish new trade relations with them, including new natural gas pipelines so that Russia can sell China its natural gas instead of sending it all to Europe and Germany. So they've helped somewhat, but they've kind of stayed on the sidelines. I do think that China in some ways is a troubled society. I'm not sure that Uncle Xi, the president for life, is as is as safe in his position as a lot of people suppose he is, because he made himself president for life or something like that. I think that he has some opposition, I think, in the Communist Party, and it's not inconsiderable. The Chinese economy has strange fragilities built into it because their banking system doesn't have to answer to anybody, really. You know, whatever it has to answer to the general market, and there is a general market in China now after 30 years of liberalization. It still ultimately only answers to the Chinese Communist Party, which can paper over its problems at will. But like the American central bank, the Federal Reserve, the Chinese Communist Party has only so much ability to paper over its economic and financial problems, because ultimately stuff has to pencil out on the books. You can only cook the books for so long before your business model fails. And, you know, their business model has been based on mass export of consumer goods. If they find, you know, we find ourselves now, the US and China and the West and China generally, in a state of friction that didn't exist during the height of globalism. And that friction is producing heat, and that heat is disrupting supply lines and manufacturing chains. And I'm not and I think we have to remember too that China is in some ways in a much more fragile position vis-a-vis its energy imports than even we are. Europe, it compares at least to Europe's predicament, but China does not have very much in the way of oil reserves. And they have to import a heck of a lot of oil. I think it's something like 5 million barrels a day. I'm not sure. It's less than we do, I believe, but they import a lot of oil, and it has to come a long way. Mm-hmm. A lot of it comes from the Middle East, and it goes through a couple of choke points. It goes through the Persian Gulf and the choke point there. Straits of Hormuz, and it goes through the Straits of Malacca, which is a choke point in shipping through the Indonesian archipelago. And what it means is these are trade routes for giant oil tankers that can be interrupted very easily. You know, you can just mine them or sink ships there and create problems for ships coming through. So I think that their lifeline for oil imports is very tenuous, and they know it. And that's their weak spot. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Japan is actually, which we don't think of in any way as an adversarial nation for us now, you know, but it's an important nation. And if we got into any kind of a conflict with China, we would probably have to enlist Japan for help in some way, but they don't have any of their petroleum. You know, they ran into that problem in World War II. That's why they went island hopping towards Indonesia, where the oil was. Mm-hmm. And you know, if they're cut off, they're not going to be able to help us or help themselves. So that corner of the world has got problems.
Yeah, interestingly, a lot of these issues just come back to the energy problem.
They do.
And you know, the ability to have domestic supply of energy is something that is of utmost importance. And yet
resource. Mm-hmm. It's the primary resource of an industrial civilization, mm-hmm. at least at this level of development. And as I said, we don't have a next energy to turn to really at the moment. I mean, we can do nuclear, but one of the problems with nuclear, and there are new forms of nuclear, supposedly, you know, the thorium reactors that are supposedly ultra safe, et cetera, et cetera. But now that we are in a kind of vortex of capital disappearing, we have to figure in that we may not have the capital in the years ahead to build the kind of things that we need to keep on doing what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, capital is going to disappear ferociously as debts fail to be repaid. That's the core of the debt problem, is that when debts are not repaid or not serviced, money disappears from the system. It's really a very simple process. Mm-hmm. That's a debt deflation. And that's different than a, you know, a monetary inflation. It's the opposite in a way. But there are two ways of going broke. You know, you can either have no money or you can have a lot of money that's worthless. And we actually seem to be heading to both of those ends of the spectrum at the same time. And it'll be interesting to see how we get there, because, you know, we have every reason to believe that the bottom's going to fall out under the financial markets, the bond market and the stock market. The bond market is already wobbling pretty badly. Mm-hmm. The stock market has been sort of looking like it's topping. But when those two markets get into trouble, a lot of wealth is going to disappear. A lot of wealth in the form of, you know, financial instruments that represent money or capital. And that's stocks and bonds and derivatives and bets and, you know, puts and you know, every kind of instrument that's out there is liable to lose its value. And one of the big unfortunate byproducts of the games we've been playing with money, especially with central banks, is that they've destroyed what's known as the price discovery mechanism for markets, mm-hmm. which means markets have one primary job, which is to tell you what things are worth, especially financial instruments and securities that pretend to represent money. You know, and if it looks like it's going to turn out that these things don't represent the amount of money they pretended to, and that the markets were giving a false signal for years, and now that has to be corrected. If you're going to ever return to any kind of a functional market, it has to correct, and probably pretty severely. Mm-hmm. So two things will happen. Money will disappear, plus the value of the currency that is still the currency is going to drop. And it's going to be a ferocious 1-2 punch. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people who are really rich are going to find out they're not so rich. And all the normal people out there are going to find out they, you know, that their money will buy them nothing. Mm-hmm. So
it's pretty tough. Yeah, and it's crazy to think about, you know, on one hand, we're thinking about the destruction of this capital. And then on the other hand, we're also thinking about the amount of dollars that can come streaming back into the U.S. that, as you said earlier, and it's a point worth reiterating, that the amount of dollars that the U.S. has exported all over the world and the amount of inflation, when that comes home to roost, the destruction of that purchasing power is going to be incredible.
Yeah, and how does it come home to roost? It comes home to roost when you compromise the banking system, as we've done with our sanctions, mm-hmm. and you confiscate sovereign wealth of other countries or the wealth of individuals, and then you prove that you're not a reliable fiduciary, mm-hmm. that people can't trust you to park their money in your banks or in your systems. And that's exactly what we've done. And the consequence of that will be that money will be coming back to the United States from the people who don't want to hold it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting.
They'll sell it for other currencies and other things. Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, again, to your earlier point of the U.S. possibly going back on their sanctions, just like the inflation, let's say, puzzle piece, that is not a genie that can be put back in the bottle just by, you know, removing the sanctions or going back on the sanctions.
Yeah, not easily.
The path that has been established by Russia to trade with other countries in something other than U.S. dollars is not, you know, a genie that can be put back in the bottle, right?
Yeah, and why would they want to? Because they've already been screwed by the West. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had a perfectly good pipeline in the Nord Stream pipeline that was ready to open. All they needed to do was go through some procedural BS to get it going. And, you know, the Germans said, oh, no, we're not going to do that. So, you know, the Russians said, fine, you know, we'll just walk away from that for now. and see, you know, see how the rest of your winter goes. And, or the rest of, you know, the cold part of the spring anyway. And, you know, they're over, they got them over a barrel.
Well, I think that's, enough craziness for today, Jim. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss before we do wrap up?
I just want to say that, you know, we're facing a period of considerable turbulence and probably some hardship. And let's just stop being crybabies. Let's stop wringing our hands. You know, let's put our shoulder to the wheel and start thinking straight about what we can do. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that revolves around relocalizing your life and downscaling our activities in ways that will allow us to keep doing stuff and producing things that we need, especially food. And, you know, if we keep our mind on that, I think that'll be a good track for us.
Mm-hmm. Well said, Jim. Of course, all your books are available on Amazon and your blog, and basically the links to all of your stuff is available at kunstler.com,
KUNSTLER.com, including my blog every Monday and every Friday, and not the days in between, twice a week, and drop in. And, you know, I try to lay it out in the most reality friendly way I can do it. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for your time today, Jim.
You're welcome, Tom. Pleasure to be with you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.